you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Joe Atwell back on the show. Joe is a researcher and independent scholar. He's the author of Shakespeare's Secret Messiah and Caesar's Messiah, The Roman Conspiracy to Invent Jesus. His website is postflaviana.org. Joe also co-hosts The Secret Society Revealed, a weekly podcast that is carried on the Revolution Radio Network. Joe, how are you doing this evening?
Great, Tim. How are you?
Very good. Very good. Thanks for coming back on the show.
My pleasure.
And well, tonight I want to discuss. You've done a number of interviews and podcasts regarding the topics of Gloria Steinem, her legend, Bill Gates, his legend. You've deconstructed those figures. You also have discussed secret society's agenda to degrade society by destroying the family, promoting transgenderism, sort of degenerate behavior. For the objective of atomizing society. We're kind of all over the place, but all these things are kind of related. How would you want to address all those topics?
Well, I mean, we can start out just by talking about the overall plan. It's fairly easy to trace it, in fact, because some of the information has been released by the Freedom of Information Act, and different scholars have picked up different pieces of it. Which leave a trail of fingerprints that the public can follow. They don't need to do any sort of analytic searching. They can just follow the facts. And the fact is that Gregory Bateson, who's one of the founders of the CIA, talked about the ability to control inferior people through the creation of what he called an archaic revival. And he actually referenced experiments that were going on during World War II, which would enable the superior people to control an inferior people. And these aren't, you know, my pejoratives. These are actually the way that Bateson, who represented himself as this kind of spiritual seeking Eslon attendee person, this was his language. So you could see that Bateson is what's called a lifetime actor. The presentation of his personality to the public is basically propaganda, and in back of it, there's something going on. There's something sinister. He's actually just playing a role. And then you can go forward, and you can see the Archaic Revival is actually going to get set up. We've talked about Gregory Bateson and the trip that purportedly he made to Mexico, which began the counterculture. And this was where, you know, psychedelic drugs were introduced to the American public. And then evidence came out. Scholars found that, in fact, this had, just as Bateson's work was uncovered, was something that was related to American intelligence. This was a CIA project, so Project 58. The pay requisitions exist. People can just make of it what they want, but this is the fact that that the beginning of the counterculture was created by the CIA. Now, the interesting thing is that Bateson's story was put into Life magazine, and Life magazine, you know, ran it, gave it cover exposure. And then after the fact, it turned out that Life magazine was involved with what was called Operation Mockingbird, which was basically the CIA insertion of agents into the media to control and to observe, right? The agenda is not made public, but the fact that this was going on, this has been well documented. Just as an aside, I would point out that sort of my recent research is involved with William Burroughs, who supposedly found the ayahuasca culture. And this was another component of the whole meme that was sold to the hippies about this ancient archaic revival type culture that had the spiritual connection into psychedelic drugs, either mushrooms, peyote, or in Burroughs' case, ayahuasca. But it turns out, with a little research, you can see that Burroughs was, in fact, you know, when he was purportedly wandering around the Amazon jungle, he was with, you know, intelligence agents. And that the whole meme that he was creating about this ancient culture that was using ayahuasca was just as fake as the one that was being laid on us by Carlos Castaneda, who has been outed as a CIA agent by Dr. Jay Fikes. And of course, Gordon Wasson, again, you know, you hear you have the MKUltra pay requisitions. In every case, they talk about this ancient Indian culture that used psychedelic drugs, and this is going to give the Archaic Revival, you know, a kind of energy. And it's also going to, you know, convince the hippies that taking psychedelic drugs is safe. And in fact, when you burrow into these cultures, you see that the drugs did not ever have a spiritual connection into the Indian culture. They weren't some kind of ancient phenomena. And in the oldest letters and translations of the Indian written material we have, they talk about drug use like we would talk about drug use with a Grateful Dead head, mm-hmm. that this would be something that was really, you know, counterproductive to a good and spiritual life. So this was all sold to us. The idea is basically to, you know, make people suggestible. They know that music and drugs are a way to create suggestibility. They have these lifetime actors that are, you know, basically given to us as rock and roll icons. And the next thing you know, along comes feminism. Okay, well, feminism really had as its figurehead Gloria Steinem. She was just an overnight sensation. And again, in Gloria Steinem's case, she was, and she actually was determined to be a CIA agent before anyone else had been in the counterculture. This was back in the 70s, and it's actually kind of an interesting story. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to go through how Steinem was outed as a CIA agent.
Oh, certainly.
Okay, well, what happened was Steinem just burst on the scene. Overnight, she became sort of the icon of the feminist movement. People were suspicious of her. There was already a kind of a feminist movement, but one that did not actually focus on the breaking up of the family, right? The feminist movement that existed at the time was not even promoting lesbianism. it was actually more of a, like a workers' rights type movement, and basically was kind of in the classic Marxist tradition in terms of its language. So when Gloria came around and started promoting these ideas, there was suspicion about her. And then a group that Steinem had interaction with, but who for some reason didn't trust her, they found a document, a pamphlet, which indicated that Gloria Steinem had, in the early 1960s, been a CIA agent. And it was basically a document that that she had created that was produced by the CIA, which outlined a whole group of people and their political positions. And it was just basically an intelligence report written by a CIA officer concerning a youth festival in Finland. And so when they found this, they confronted her, and she denied it. She said that this, you know, she didn't know that she was working for the CIA. But they continued doing research, and they found that she had been on the board of directors of an organization called the General Research Service, if my memory serves. And that this organization, excuse me, was the Independent Research Service. And so that organization then was listed in the CIA's own kind of outsourced information about organization that it was funding and controlled. That component then came into their hands, and they knew that Gloria was lying. And so they created a press conference, and they said, look, you know, she's related to the CIA. She's a CIA agent. And what they found was that she claimed that she worked for. So then she came forward and she said, OK, I was caught. You know, she said, I admit this. She said that it was way back when, it was between her connection to the agency was between 62 and 64. And she wasn't really sure she was working for the CIA. And in fact, they were really liberal. And that she really was heartened by the fact that there were so many liberals inside the CIA, and this was like the McCarthy era in America. And so she just felt that these people were really liberal-minded people, and this was great. However, it then came out that this Independent Research Service was still in existence and still a CIA operation. And this was at the time that Ms. Magazine was being formed, 1969. So her research with the CIA is actually begun as early as 1959, and then was still being documented as late as 1969 when Ms. Magazine was starting to come into existence. And so they then went public, and there is an absolutely fascinating interview. I believe it was in the 70s. It could have been the 80s with a woman named Sarah Fairchild. And she was in this group, the Red Stockings. And these were these radical feminists who uncovered the fact that Gloria Steinem was a CIA agent. Now, these are basically, I would say, kind of sexual Marxists. You know, she uses the word radical all the time. And there's actually a recording of a question and answer session that she did concerning Steinem. She was talking about, well, how we found out about her being a CIA agent, why we are worried right now. And this is where I find it's so fascinating, because they were very worried that finding the fact that she'd lied about being an agent, and then finding out the fact that this Independent Research Service was still in existence, and that she was still lying about it, they then didn't trust her motivation for being in the feminist movement. And but she couldn't quite explain why she thought Steinem's, you know, was a CIA agent that was being somehow paid to produce feminism. She didn't understand it. She really was just, you know, she's very suspicious of it. She talks about, you know, how wrong it is to lie and things. Well, anyway, then more research was done, and it turns out that Steinem's claim, and this, again, is really important for citizens to know, and I encourage everyone to go and listen to the The interview that Steinem did, which is on YouTube, explaining why she was CIA agent and why the CIA was a good liberal organization. Because after that interview, other researchers went back in and basically documented the activities at this Helsinki Youth Festival. And it turned out that there was violence night after night. And that this was the Finnish press, they determined that this was actually being promoted by the CIA and that Steinem had been involved in it. So when you look at this assertion by the Finnish press that the violence was CIA oriented and that Steinem had been involved with this, and then you juxtapose that to Steinem saying, well, I was interested in the CIA because there were so many liberal people in it. Well, you can really see the malevolence, right? You can see lifetime actor trained at misdirection and sophistry. But in back of all that, there's something really vicious and violent. So Steinem then started Ms. Magazine. And what's interesting about the Fairchild interview is that two facts came out after the interview that she was unaware of, one of which is this Operation Mockingbird, because Operation Mockingbird was the CIA's attempt to control America's media, which you'd obviously would suspect that Ms. Magazine would be one of their components, right? I mean, very natural assertion, but the Red Stockings didn't know this. They had no idea about it. But it turns out that Steinem's direct boss when she was in Helsinki as an agent was the person who was running Operation Mockingbird, Cord Myers. So this was a direct connection from Steinem and Ms. Magazine into Ms. Magazine. And then beyond this, what really then sealed the deal was that it turned out that in the cell of CIA agents that she was involved with, there was an individual in Helsinki, there was an individual named Clay Felker, right? Well, then it turned out he was in this independent research group with Steinem. He was at Helsinki in 1962, but then he became the editor of Esquire, right? He was the one who published Steinem's early feminist article. He hired Steinem, gave her money, and Felker then published the first edition of Ms. Magazine as an insert to New York Magazine that Felker was the publisher of. And so now the picture of what had happened is too vivid for anyone to overlook. I mean, Ms. Magazine was basically was something that the CIA had created. The funding for Ms. Magazine came through Warner Communications, right? And also Kathleen Graham. Graham has also been shown to have had CIA connections. Warner Communications becomes Time Warner, Time Life Warner. So you can see, that this is all, just adding up to a very clear picture. And then now notice the name of the magazine, Ms. Okay, well, here's where you can start talking about the agenda, because, you had Miss and Mrs. These were descriptions of a woman's state relative to marriage. But then Ms. became very popular. It was the title of the magazine. And you can see that this is a, that marriage is irrelevant, right? It isn't the important, identifying aspect. Ms. is just generic, right? So this is just subliminally against the creation of families from the very beginning. I think is the most criminal moment in the Ms. Magazine history was its backing of a book called Black Macho. So what happens there's a supposedly a black activist named Michelle Wallace. She's in her very early 20s, and she comes up with this book which is completely opposed to marriage to black men in general. She calls them, macho pigs. She has a lot of really kind of violent descriptions of the black male in the book. Gloria Steinem claimed that Wallace's book would define the future of black relationships. And she pushed hard to make sure the book received massive publicity, right? This actually was then, kind of paralleled with what was going on in Hollywood, which was basically creating kind of a pimp image for the black male. And so now, and then, of course, this is all working together with the Great Society programs, where the financing for the black family had changed from the black male being a participant to it being handed over to the state, basically. Because, you know, if you had a family, you couldn't receive welfare, or it was much more difficult. Whereas if you were a single woman and black, it was automatic. So now you had a change in demographic statistics. In terms of out of wedlock births, education levels, income levels, and then the misery index, drug use, all these things. These things had all been basically, to the best that they can trace them, they'd all been more or less on an uptrend since the Civil War. Now, suddenly in like the mid-60s with the Great Society programs, they basically go off a cliff. And clearly you can see the malfeasance, because if they had not wanted these results, they could look at the statistics and they could have changed the policies, which were obviously responsible at any time. But they didn't, right? So I think what the plan is that they were going to attack the black family hardest and earliest because it was the most vulnerable. And the idea is they could create basically a culture that was atomized, right? The family was no longer in existence. And then that culture they could merge with the basically deracinated white middle class that were going to be losing their ethnic identities, right? The ethnic neighborhoods, would start to be broken apart by the suburbanization and all the different social policies. You'd just have this deracinated white middle class, which would be listening to rhythm and blues and having a lot of drug use, and of course, pornography. And then you would basically be moving, very steadily toward the culture we have today, where integration is, given as a cultural value, mother and of course, the family is just evaporating. I'll shut up here in a second. Last little thing is that a friend of mine, I was just talking to him, and he was saying, when he grew up in Lake Erie, Irish family, and he said we lived in an Irish community. And he says, when I was a kid, there was a guy that came into town and he was selling pornography. It was just pictures, dirty pictures. He said the dads found out and got the guy and beat him up, right? See, ethnic community responds and then repulses, the pollution. Mm-hmm. Well, once that broke apart and you just had these isolated families, these suburban streets, there wasn't the kind of connections and family, ethnic extended family stuff that was going on before, you didn't have this capacity to defend itself. And this had been understood, by the people who were designing it all.
Yes. Yes. Well, one thing you mentioned, Hollywood's effort in this, that's the black exploitation films of the 70s.
Exploitation, yeah.
Yeah, and right. This, you mentioned Time Life, and of course that had a direct connection because the director of those films was a photographer for Time Life, Gordon Parks, a black photographer who was sent in as an agent to take pictures of the Black Panthers.
Right.
And he directed the Shaft films and Superfly. I think he handed one off to his son. These movies were made for that purpose, as you said, to promote the sort of the pimp culture, the criminal culture, and the connection. I think was Jim Aubrey, who was the head of MGM Studios. They're the ones that produced these films, the Shaft films, and he was more or less an asset or an agent of the CIA. So that's where.
So again, it's just very, very clear. And you see what it, you know, it's funny, like the way that they don't permit basically any kind of questioning about Steinem's connection into the agency, because it's such an obvious fact and something that, I mean, she's still in play. I mean, she was here in Santa Barbara last month speaking to people. You'd wonder why people aren't questioning her about this. There's a complete blackout because, you see, it leads to the big question, which is what is the nature of the intelligence agencies, right, that have so much power in our country, who basically run it? I mean, if the CIA was found to be creating feminism, then it would bring the question to mind of, well, why? What are they doing? And you see, this is the thing. It's the same question that lies in back of things like the Grateful Dead, Gordon Wasson's trip to Mexico to, you know, which turns out to be bogus, or William Burroughs, you know, finding an ancient ayahuasca culture in the Peruvian jungle. I mean, these stories are all bogus. They're all directly connected, you know, by the personnel involved in these trips to the CIA. But they raise the question of, well, what is the CIA's role in our culture? What in the hell are these guys doing? And you see, this is what they don't want people to ask. This is the real question, is what are they doing? Why are they creating a debased culture? What is the end game in all of this? And so, you know, what I hope is that we will become basically an army of researchers, not just, you know, the thousands that are out there now, but in the millions of people who are in communication, exchanging information, and basically studying them in the same way that they have studied and manipulated us. You know, we just can't have a normal, good life if we don't answer these questions. We've got to find out why they perverted culture, mm-hmm. why they created single mom and the pornographic male. You know, what was in back of it? To me, the answer is obvious. This ends up in genocide.
Yeah.
This is basically, you know, they're going to stratify into, you know, dumbed down. And I mean, by dumbed down, I mean both genetically and chemically dumbed down individuals who probably are at risk of being replaced by robots at this point. And just the elites, right? Yeah. Whoever they are, whatever they are.
Yeah, because through the culture, they've created, a dominant strain of female, which a woman who is temperamentally not predisposed to being a mother. She looks about the career because she needs to be independent. And they create the economic and cultural conditions where much of that attitude is justified because you can't depend on the male who's addicted to pornography.
Of course. I mean, he's exactly right. I mean, you know, we talk a lot with women they call in different shows I'm on. And there's an expression that's very interesting to me. They talk about the difficulty in finding a good quality male. It's an expression that's kind of out there, the good quality male. And I always ask them to define it. And I mean, basically, they're just talking about someone who hasn't succumbed to the cultural debasement.
Yeah. Knows how to be a dad, more or less.
Yeah, that wants to be a father. Wants to have a family. That doesn't want to watch pornography 6 hours a day or something, you know. And also as you know, is someone who is sexually capable of being a male. Because like you were saying, you know, they have these females that are, you know, basically you can see them psychologically incapable of relating to family and mother. They would see this as, you know, slavery or something. But on the other side, you have not just the pornographic male, but also the transsexual male, you know, the gay male. I mean, you know, they have so many toxins in their environment that decrease testosterone. I mean, the most obvious fact that faces us is this declining sperm count. I mean, this has to be something so simple to look at. It's the measurements are very obvious and clear, and it just shows you that they have been working at this for, you know, 100 years to find ways to demasculinize the males. And then, of course, at the same time, then they produce the homosexual media culture, Mm-hmm. You know, you have like Bruce Jenner is getting an award from Obama, you know, and you know. So that then pulls people from the cultural side.
Yeah, this everywhere you look, there's some headline regarding some homosexual issue. I just, you know, I just read the headline today. Apparently, the person who invented the gay flag passed away recently, and I'm reading the headlines as if you know I should know who this person is.
Well, why isn't there a national holiday? In his honor. I mean, it's just they have the media. It just looks like a cesspool. Mm-hmm. The fact is, it's a weapon, and the elements that are now just in full throttle, because you know, in 1950, that you know, such a you know, proclamation about the gay flag wouldn't have been news, but now, you know, the news that would be related to like healthy family production doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah,
you know.
Whereas in 1950, at least the overt culture was considered hospitable to the raising of children, and now it's become hostile, overtly hostile to it. Even, and it's not just the news and what's covered in the news; it's the TV shows. If you watch your general affair of what's on the networks and what's on the various cable shows, you would assume that every other person is a homosexual or lesbian. Good example is if there's a family, you know, what we would consider a normal family, has been pathologized and declared dysfunctional, and the only normal people, only functional relationships in many of these TV shows are homosexual relationships, same-sex relationships.
It's you know, basically kind of neuro-linguistic programming. They're just socializing a non-family producing culture. Mm-hmm. Giving people the cues that this is not just acceptable but desirable, and so you know, what are you going to do if you're you know, someone who has the heterosexual tradition and wants to have you know, the routine family or the old-fashioned family? You know, you just have to separate yourself from the media. I mean, I recommend people just absolutely try to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
Learn to get information through the internet at sources that you deem coherent and are reliable and that you can communicate with. I would say that you don't want to just, you know, no more just talking heads. You really want the capacity to communicate and to vet news. And then to not watch whatsoever anything that has Miley Cyrus or the Kardashians Kanan West, whatever the guy is. I mean, this isn't just a cesspool. I mean, it looks like a cesspool. It is a cesspool, but it's a weapon. It's designed to basically produce a culture that is incapable of regenerating itself. You know, I mean, that's it all ends up as a kind of birth control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the men are gay and all the women are lesbian, then that's the end of that, is the last generation. And so this has always been the plan. It was the plan of Edward Bernays, Sigmund Freud's nephew. It's certainly the plan, you know, people like Allen Ginsberg. You know, you can just deconstruct the poetry, deconstruct the literature. You can see that this malevolence is in motion all the time. It has as one of its focuses the CIA and you know, the intelligence agencies, because they're secret societies. This is why they were created. You know, you have the overt secret societies like Freemasonry and Skull and Bones, Bohemian Grove, and these are in fact part of the operation against European culture, just no question. But to conduct larger governmental operations, they needed to create secret societies inside government, and that's what the CIA is.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it was. It became formalized with the National Security Act of 1947, and its excuse was the Cold War, the so-called threat of communism, which is really a creation of London and New York to begin with, anyway, to create that dialectic.
Exactly,
which goes back to this whole, you know, Freemasonic project of traumatizing society, you know, through you know,
so that we would need, you know, in the crisis, they can basically insert political leaders. I mean, basically, the key component here is, like, you have lifetime actors. We don't know who they are, what their ethnicity is, what their background are. They come forward. They're always talking about making things better, right? Workers' paradise. They've got some kind of, you know, economic or social program that's going to help with the crisis. And then the next thing you know, like, millions of people are dying. Mm-hmm. And this just happens over and over again. And so the... you know, and this, of course, and just over and over again, is connected into Freemasonry. But they have to rebrand it. You know, this is why you have Skull and Bones and Bohemian Grove, because if it was simply the Freemasons, the high-level Freemasons, then it would be too visible. And so, you know, you'd get different organizations. And then now you have the CIA and then the NSA and the different, you know, agencies. But the public doesn't get to see inside any of them. Mm-hmm. When you trace back cultural debasement, you find they are at the center of virtually all of it.
Mm-hmm. Feminism, modern art, population control, birth control, these things. The breakup of the, you mentioned the breakup of the ethnic neighborhoods, and what they've created was a sort of this ethno-masochism where you learn to hate your own ethnic roots because you become cut off from them, and you also... Through the pretext of racial integration and justice, they smashed these neighborhoods up in the 50s and 60s. This is all part of a process. But this weakened, again, this weakened the cultural resistance to the planned sexual revolution, the cultural revolution.
Pornography. And also to the laws, because, you know, you had, with FDR, you had the destruction of the local sovereignties. In other words, you know, in the old days, township, county, state, they could make their own laws concerning sexual mores, for example. Yeah. You know, they could outlaw homosexuality. But then federalism, you know, onset, and you had all of these projects and legal programs that were coming out of, you know, FDR's administration that were going to take away from the sovereigns, the little sovereigns, the capacity to basically defend themselves. And so now you've got the deracinated white middle class with no ethnic energy to be able to resist anything. And you've put it in a situation where it doesn't have the capacity to even, like, create its own laws concerning, you know, sexual activity. And so now here comes the pornography culture.
Yeah, that was, right? I think it was the Roth decision in the 50s that treated obscenity as free speech.
Yeah,
and
that's right.
Yeah, destroyed that local policing.
It was the end.
Yeah, and then also in the 60s, you had the Griswold v. Connecticut, which legalized contraception. But really, if you were adult, you had no problem getting hold of condoms, things like that. But by declaring it a constitutional right, access to contraceptions, the government could get in the business of actually promoting it. And within a few years, because of the crisis of teenage pregnancy, promoted by Time Life, right? On the cover of Time Life.
Shock.
They open up clinics in schools on the funding of Planned Parenthood, you know, which gets us to none other than Bill Gates.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? You know, so Planned Parenthood, you know, was basically a renamed, program. It came out of the eugenics movement and had at the beginning, basically population control, right? As its goal, it just stated that it was going to reduce population, and this, so it was seen kind of as a, I would say with some concern, you know, as it came, you know, into our culture. But then it changed its name to Planned Parenthood, with particularly when the birth control pill came about. Mm-hmm. But it was directly, you know, the descendant of the eugenics movement from the Huxleys. You know, and it was actually the same organization. It had just basically morphed a couple times and changed its name, I think, twice in the course of its history. But this was the organization, and it was run by Bill Gates' father, right? So this shows that Gates' family is, you know, not what they you know, kind of claim to be. You have to wonder about the lifetime acting component to them. And so Gates comes along and, you know, he's a college dropout, and he's given the opportunity to create the operating system for the IBM personal computer. Now, I was in the computer software business at this time, and I can just guarantee you that virtually everyone who heard about this wondered what was in back of it. Because even at that point, before the personal computers had become, you know, basically in everyone's bedroom, people could see that they were going to be basically ubiquitous. There was no question that these were going to be everywhere. And no one could understand why IBM would give away the creation of the operating system to someone who couldn't code, someone who wasn't really a software designer, and someone who had no business. At the time that Gates created the relationship, he didn't even have an operating system. He actually bought DOS from some guy who lived down the street. It was just a very primitive operating system, full of bugs. It got better, of course, over time. But the creation of the relationship to Gates was very suspicious. And, of course, in hindsight, it is clear that Gates was part of the guild that had in mind this kind of cultural control. And then you have to see the personal computer and, of course, the iPhone, this thing that everyone now stares at all day long, that this comes out of Silicon Valley and it comes out of MKUltra, right? If you look at Stuart Brand, for example, he is on the bus. He is a merry prankster. He is basically working with Ken Kesey, the MKUltra employee. There's his background, his military intelligence. And he's actually the individual who came up with the name personal computer. He's the individual who created the press conference that the mouse was introduced to the public. And you know, you have to wonder again. It's sort of like feminism, you know, without kind of being able to move back and sequence and see how these things develop, it's hard at the present time to sort of see, you know, what was in back of all this. You have to remember that the MKUltra project came out of the MACI conference. And at the MACI conference, you had the cybernetics conferences. These were particular conferences inside of the MACI conference, which were studying how humans could be programmed. The term cybernetics comes out of this. And the people who were there were actually talking about how they could code humans. And so the idea of the personal computer was just to basically begin the process by which they could control individuals' behavior, right? If you look at the iPhone and you think about the connections to military intelligence that Google and Facebook have, and you look at the fact that has now been released that every iPhone ever made has been hacked by the CIA so that they can monitor activity, right? Mm-hmm. And monitor email, you know, what you're doing in the email. They know where you are. They're now, of course, they're actually watching, you know, financial transactions going on. So why would they do, you know, what was the plan? Because as we look at it today, the iPhone is such a handy gadget. You know, well, how could this be wrong? Well, you always have to think about the reason that these things were created, because and why? Because this will tell you what the people who control them today are actually doing. If you can answer the questions at the beginning, right? When you look at the cybernetics conferences inside the MACI, and when you study the work of Norbert Wiener and Johann von Neumann, you can see they're talking about you can control human beings, you can program them, you can code them like a machine, right? Now, then as you trace these individuals going forward and you can see the circumstantial evidence that always links them together, then you can see this is really what they have in mind. I mean, these are just ways to give government an observation power that is, you know, like the police song, every step you take, you know, every move you make, I'll be watching you. And of course, you know, the drummer Copeland was, you know, his father was one of the founders of the CIA with Bateson. And so, you know, these songs, you know, they seem harmless. They get into our mind, but believe me, there is malevolence in back of them. And, mm-hmm. and they do intend to be able to have a complete observation of all humans that, you know, during this process, while population is being reduced.
What's interesting, you mentioned this cybernetic agenda behind Silicon Valley and the personal computer and the iPhone and sort of the ubiquitousness of all this technology. You have the Internet of Things, you know, where our toasters spy on us. That wasn't just Kellyanne Fitzpatrick who said that. I think it was the former director of the CIA said that in front of in a congressional hearing, that your utilities, your refrigerator or your toaster would have to take the ability to surveil you.
Your microwave, whatever.
But the I did a recent interview with Dr. Joseph Farrell, and he wrote a book called Rotten to the Common Core. And in that book, he didn't so much focus on the standards, which gets most of the attention. The critics of Common Core, he focused on it, the fact that on its electronic standardized testing and the surveillance potential or agenda behind it. And in researching that book, he came up with the connection between the electronic testing service, I think it was developed out of Harvard University, to the human to the human ecology fund.
Sure. Yeah.
So that you know, of course, yeah. you mentioned who human ecology fund. That's CIA. That's Ewan Cameron. That's MK Ultra. So from the get-go, the standardized testing is a way of monitoring, of tracking, and classifying every student in the country.
Exactly, and they could then see, you know, if there is a particular class that is troublesome, you know, like very high scores in English, then they would have a heads up as to which group they needed to do extra monitoring of.
Yeah.
Because now once they have them identified through the, you know, the SAT or the different tests, the standardized intelligence so-called tests that are given to the students, then they could refine this with the, you know, these expertise knowledge and then say, okay, this group, these 5,000 people have the intelligence and, by their internet activity, we can see they're at the wrong websites. So now we have to go to the next level of surveillance.
Yeah, and right? this should all be done through a complex algorithm. So we're all being, you know, more or less virtually or digitally classified and filed. We all have a control file. But you know, he made a point, is just with standardized testing, with electronic testing, that you get a question, and you know, you have to, with your number two pencil, you got to pick the right answer. And you say you get a history question of who killed President John F. Kennedy, right? I mean, A, John Wilkes Booth, you know, B, Sirhan, C, Lee Harvey Oswald. Not gonna have D, a confluence of interest representing elements within the national security state, organized crime, you know, the Mossad. You're not going to have that, you know. But there's a system of reward and punishment here, because if you give the right answer, the politically correct answer, you get the higher score. So it's a way of standardizing and dumbing down everything as well, knowledge and information.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly right. This is how we're socialized. You know, there's all these different means that socialize us. And, you know, if you are aware, you can see them just everywhere inside the media culture. They're just everywhere. You know, basically every movie has elements of it. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that's why I'm saying that, you know, we're at a point where we have to really work hard to defend ourselves and defend our children so their minds can develop naturally. And so that means you cannot let them experience modern media. It's a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
I know this is a tough nut to crack because it makes sleepovers a little complicated, but that's just how it is. If you want
that's the most difficult thing, is because, all around you it's happening. You can do what you can, but they're friends, and if they do go to a regular school, which is nothing, you also have to consider pulling a kid out of the normal methods of education, modern education, because that's weaponized as well too. So,
absolutely. I mean, I hate to say it, but public education is simply it's just a cesspool and a weapon. Of course, in California, if you want to be in the public schools, you've got to have your kid take 67 vaccinations.
So, yeah, yeah, exactly, yeah.
Right off the bat, you know, if you're a parent and you want to protect your children, I would suggest doing a little research into the dangers of vaccinations and to the absolute lack of any kind of evidence that they are effective at preventing any sort of disease or mortality. And so, you know, you've got to stand up for your child, which is to say you've organized yourself into educational groups. I mean, homeschooling is just becoming more and more popular. And I mean, this is obviously just necessary. And then socialization within the homeschooling component, you know, where you can kind of arrange for people to be around the child that are not there to do damage, you know. Mm. And so that's what just a parent has to do these days. And so everyone should support this, you know, even if you don't have children. People should try to support it as best they can, offer to volunteer as just to help parents, you know, make these achievements. Because, you know, if we want to create culture for the future, have a culture in the future, have any existence in the future, we need another generation. And, you know, you're not going to produce anyone who's clear-minded through the public school system and the pornography culture.
Yes. Now, you were talking about Bill Gates and the legend of Bill Gates, and a lot of people seem to think, again, he is a lifetime actor, and the story doesn't really add up. He right. seemed to have been, like, maybe with Microsoft was maybe a tax dodge or some way to get around, you know, antitrust, you know, laws or something. But, you know,
Microsoft was just, they wanted to get the operating system of what they were going to have as their common platform for observation of humans. And they wanted to move it away from IBM because IBM was already seen as something that was kind of like big brother.
Yes.
So with Apple, which is, you know, sort of like the Rolling Stones to the Beatles, you know, basically Apple to Microsoft, you know.
That's right, yeah.
You had this idea that it was a kind of rebellion, you know, against IBM. I mean, this is how they set these things up.
So yeah, it's a Revenge of the Nerds versus the cool Steve Jobs. It's like you know, if you want to sell something, you need a Ronald McDonald or a Betty Crocker. So to get these guys, you get a face to sell the product. It's Bill Gates. And he represents a certain type, and then Steve Jobs, and he's a certain type.
And it just keeps getting a little more radical because you know, you start out with IBM, then you have Bill Gates, and he's kind of this nerdy guy, but he's eccentric and he's different than IBM, right? He's part of this new generation of hackers, you know. But then beyond him, now you have Jobs. Well, Jobs takes LSD, you know.
Yeah.
And he's a famous drug user, you know. And now this is. Surely someone that the youth culture can embrace his products. And then, wow, lo and behold, here comes the iPhone and the iPod. Wow, what an amazing trajectory. And, you know, you end up with these things all staring at your face. And then, like, 2 weeks ago, you learn that, oh, by the way, the CIA has hacked every single iPhone.
Yeah.
They have technology to look at every single. So all of this time, you've been sitting there conditioning yourself, learning how to type with your thumbs and exchanging, you know, tweets with your internet circle, you have been observed, right? Mm-hmm. Your ability to have privacy and, you know, unreasonable search and seizure has been violated, right? The intelligence community, which people should understand is a secret society, right? Democracy does not penetrate into this. No one that you know has any understanding whatsoever of what's going inside the CIA's headquarters, right?
Someone like Bill Gates becomes a celebrity, of course, a multi-billionaire.
Sure.
At one time, officially the richest man in the world, probably wasn't true, of course. But he uses his capital, his moral or cultural capital. Then he opens. Creates his foundation with his wife Melinda, and they're out there promoting GMO vaccinations.
Yeah,
the whole agenda. Right? They're out there.
I mean, it's just absurd. Yeah. But that's the lifetime actor. You know, he creates the trust and then he delivers the blow. This is you know, what people need, how people need to organize themselves to be able to, you know, defend children, is they've got to be able to identify when the lifetime actor is coming at them, you know, with a load of weaponized anthropology.
Yeah, I was reading an article about Silicon Valley in anticipation of this interview by Bill Blunden. Silicon Valley sells the illusion of security. And this, you get in this false conflict between these, you know, these tech nerds and the government. And he, this is what he writes. He goes, the truth is that government is more than happy to cede power and authority just as long as it's doing so serves the corporate factions that have achieved state capture. The empire Glenn Greenwald speaks of is a corporate empire. In concrete analytic results that affirm Thomas Ferguson's investment theory of party competition, researchers from Princeton and Northwestern University conclude that multivariate analysis indicates that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while the average citizen and mass-based interest groups have little or no influence. Now, here's the kicker. The primacy of security theater. Certainly, large high-tech companies care about quarterly earnings. That definitely explains all the tax evasion, wage ceilings, and slave labor. But these same companies would be hard-pressed to actually protest user privacy because spying on users is a fundamental part of their business model. Like government, corporate spies collect and monetize oceans of data. Furthermore, high-tech players don't need to actually bulletproof their products to win back customers. It's far more cost-effective to simply manufacture the perception of better security, slap on some crypto, flood the news with public relation pieces, and get some government officials, example given, James Comey, Robert Hannigan, and Stuart Baker, to whine visibly about the purported enhancements in order to lend the marketing campaign's credibility. The techno-libertarians of Silicon Valley are masters of security theater.
Sorry. That's exactly right. Yeah. And it is theater. And that is the correct word, because anytime they want to ratchet up you know, the surveillance, they can simply stage a terrorist event and have the people use iPhones to communicate, and then they can say, well, you know, we need this this new gizmo to be able to look at everybody. You know, lifetime actors, it's just, you've got to be able to identify them. And, you know, one individual that I think is very useful to study in this regard is Gloria Steinem. Mm-hmm. I think people should look at how she came on the scene, how she became out of nowhere the representative of feminism. I mean, this was what was so confusing to what was called the Red Stockings, which were the old line kind of Marxist feminist group that were, I think, just legitimate, individuals with economic issues. But somehow just Steinem just comes out of nowhere. And if you look at, you know, how she is promoted, and then try to back calculate from there to like Kim Kardashian, Miley Cyrus. I mean, all of these individuals, or even Barack Obama, mm-hmm. they're handpicked puppets, basically. And then once the planning is in place, they just either burst onto the scene, or like in the case of Miley Cyrus, they have a reason for developing her from a young age. You know, with Miley Cyrus, she was developed from a young age, so you'd have a lot of identification with her person from young girls, right? So she had this Hannah Montana character as like she started maybe 10 years old through 14. But then her transition into the Whore of Babylon Miley Cyrus is overnight, right? She just bursts on the scene as the Whore of Babylon, and every single magazine is covering her, right? The whole Time Warner empire is just falling around like, you know, she's, an important person. But the question is why? You know, well, this is weaponized anthropology, folks. This is what we're experiencing.
And this is, in each of these cases, you need, I guess, parents who are willing to sell off their children for money or fame. And,
well, I think they're probably just, they're, you know, it's like with the Grateful Dead. I mean, the Grateful Dead, there's been a lot of research done into them, and the thing that's probably the most important about the Grateful Dead is that they're from Masonic families. if you go into their family background, Courtney Cox's father, Hank Harrison, was the band handler. And he was in an interview where, you know, they asked him, well, why were all of the pamphlets and all of the early representations of the Grateful Dead, you know, even when they were the Warlocks before they were dead, why is it all Freemasonry? Why is there nothing but the all-seeing eye and the temples of Joaquin and Boas and nothing but Freemason imagery? And he goes, well, it's easy to answer. He goes, we're all from Masonic families. That's why. And so really, I mean, isn't that a little unusual, right? I mean, did it have something to do with the creation of the band? What you get to, Tim, is you always, if you dig a bit, when you get to weapons, you typically find that the family has some kind of connection into Freemasonry or into government intelligence, right? I mean, Jim Morrison's father was the admiral of, the Gulf of Tonkin episode. Frank Zappa's dad was, you know, this chemist that was working for the CIA and LSD. I mean, you know, and then the dead have nothing but Masons. So this is, it's the secret societies that are formed so that they can conduct malevolence without being observed, right? I mean, that's why the societies are secret. They're not secret because they're trying to figure out how they can be benevolent. You know, that's the secrecy is necessary because they're doing evil to you, to us. And that's why we are not permitted inside. And so this is why, you know, like I keep saying, we've got to have, and this would be a way to, you know, we can make progress in terms of democracy, is we need this DNA database. We need to like insist that every single person who's running for office would submit voluntarily to some kind of DNA database. And then we need to get a collection of all the media individuals, finance, media moguls, rock stars. We need to start creating a database of democracy so that when someone comes into culture and starts damaging it, we can see if there's any connections into a long-standing family of destruction, right? So that we know we're being attacked, that this individual is in some kind of existential phenomena, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a plan here that is working against us in the fact that, you know, these families go back into Freemasonry or into Skull and Bones. You know, it's like Cord Myers, the individual that hired, Gloria Steinem. I mean, his connections are right into Skull and Bones, you know, through his wife and other members in his family. I mean, You don't have to dig too hard to see these connections. And that's really the, this is the real critical research goal. People like you and I, we do our best. You know, we have the shows. We spend a lot of time. And we can even become more effective. You know, I work with groups. I work with, a lot of individuals. We try to exchange information. But this really is an all-hands work party. I mean, every citizen out there needs to participate in this. We need to become like a whole army of researchers so that there isn't any of this, secret weaponized anthropology that's being delivered against us without our awareness of it. We need to start being able to understand who is in back of the political, veneer, and start being able to make better choices. You know, if we knew that, political candidates have Masonic backgrounds, right? You see basically, you see Jewish families, Masonic families, you see families with CIA, right? Well, one thing I've been saying is that there should be some program to analyze states, right? Just say actual chance that this collection
Joe?
A better representation of the...
Hey, Joe?
Yes, sir?
You're breaking up. Let me give you...
Yes, sir?
I'm going to give you a call back so you can get a better connection. Okay. Okay, we're back again. Sorry.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm just saying that I'm hoping that the idea of the DNA database, the democracy database, it becomes popular, because this would be a really good way. You know, at first it'll make no sense. You know, you'll just have lots of data.
Yeah.
But eventually specialists and experts can go through it, and they can start seeing family and ethnic patterns, which we aren't aware of currently. And then when you go to make a democratic decision, like vote for somebody or let somebody become a judge or some kind of political power position, you'll have a better understanding of what you're getting, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so since we know that that the media is related to the intelligence community, and those who would dispute this, please simply do the research into Operation Mockingbird and see that the media was taken over by the intelligence communities.
Man. Yeah, I just finished a book, A Science of Coercion, by Christopher Simpson.
Yeah.
And and what he details in that is how the role of the CIA, the Pentagon, and U.S. security agencies in the evolution of modern communications, just the study of it, was all funded by the Pentagon, and then after World War II, at the CIA, and it was immediately weaponized. I mean, whether it's TV, radio, I mean, Yan's on research regarding in the Princeton Radio Project. From the get-go, the whole thing was weaponized.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just incredible that American people aren't really not just aware of this, but up in arms about this. Right.
Yeah.
Because when you get CNN and Fox News, you're just getting yin and yang of the, you know, secret society. You know, they're just there to condition whatever flavor of politics that they create you want to adhere to. But they're just socializing everybody. You know, I've been saying that the whole Trump Clinton thing was fake.
Mm-hmm.
You look at these personalities, they don't seem real to me. You know, the pussy-grabbing white male racist who's going to return America to greatness versus the, you know, cultural Marxist feminist from outer space. I mean, I think that what establishes their personalities is studies of what will most excite and emotionalize the people who don't like them. You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Like so what they do is they study us and they go, well, you know, here are these white males and they're unhappy about globalism, they've lost their jobs. We need someone that they are just going to be livid about, because this creates the dramatic structure of the puppet show in which you don't see the strings, mm-hmm. right? See the puppets. You know, you're just livid about this puppet. You hate the puppet. You just hate Hillary, or you hate the Donald. You know, Donald is the white male. He's the racist white male. I mean, we get the recording where he talks about grabbing pussies.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I mean, if you're going to create someone that energizes hatred in you know, say the feminist community, I think they get a pretty good job with the Donald, didn't they? You know. Yeah. And so this is what, you know, my point is that, you know, these personalities are not necessarily real. They are lifetime actors. And the structure they're being developed with is how to create emotional energy in the groups that dislike them. You see that, you know, that's why you can see why, you know, Bernie isn't you know, going to get very far politically, because no one really cares about him. Right.
Yeah.
It's just there's no energy there. Whereas with Hillary, everyone, the people who didn't like her just intensely hated her. And with Trump, it's exactly the same way. And so now you're going to get, obviously, you know, civil unrest. I mean, I think the financial situation of the United States is an absolute joke. Right. We have this pretense of being a wealthy nation when, in fact, it's just the economy is about to collapse. And now you have a collapsed economy, and with the Donald in power, well, gee, I can think of a lot of really bad, you know, gladiatorial pit type circumstances.
Yeah.
Where inner city kids out of food, you know, are not really happy. They've got a million automatic rifles, you know, and all these weapons, and you know, they're not going to put up with it. The military comes in or whatever, but you just get a bloodbath. Which, of course, in back of all, you'll have the new government agencies to take control with more power, martial law, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, this is scary times, and it's times.
Yeah, and most people just adjust to it or support it, like they did in Boston after the bombing, where they had all these ludicrous house-to-house search for two suspect. It went house to house.
People were put into martial law conditions, supposedly searching for two people who weren't even known to be armed. So this was a test. They were just seeing if there was going to be rebellion, and we fail. You know, the citizens should not have put up with it. The citizens should say, wait a second, we need to have, some kind of process that we can understand in terms of martial law. Mm-hmm. You can't have police telling people they can't come out of their house. And that's just against the Constitution. I mean, it's unreasonable. So,
same way they have you take off your shoes and go through these cancer-causing body scanners, and you get fondled at the airport.
Yeah, I know.
It's absurd.
It is absurd. It's just socialization. They're just trying to make sure that people learn to both obey and to accept radiation.
Yeah. Those drills they have at schools where they have a lot. Lockdowns, and they have unannounced drills, and they terrorize the children.
It's just socializing them and getting them basically to accept being herded into prison-like conditions, And so it's, this is why, I'd like to develop an alternative reality of my own, if I could, to get away from some of the stuff, but it's just... This is the world we got, and we just have to stand and fight. There's just no doubt about it. And
I'm going to get a pair of virtual reality goggles and set it towards my perfect libertarian utopia.
Can I come live there with you?
Or I could perfect community. My perfect community where everyone we all get along. We have communities. We talk to each other. That's my virtual reality goggles.
We have control over thing that was fascinating. I was in Cuba 2 years ago, and I spent quite a time there, and I was like studying the culture. I was fascinated by it, because the thing about Cuba is that the you have the Communist Party. It still exists, even though communism is no longer sort of the dominant economic model, which that died in the 90s when the Soviet bloc collapsed, and then Cuba didn't have any trade partners, and everyone was starving. So they developed kind of a quasi free market, system of developing food. And then from there, you got all these little tiny businesses. No one's got any money really, but it's definitely an entrepreneurial, hot zone. I mean, everyone's trying to make dough. But the thing that amazed me was how good the quality of the democracy, because the core, starting point of Cuban democracy is like 60 people. 60 people get together and elect one person who goes into this group. And from there, you start working your way up to the 30 people who are supposedly, going to elect the next prime minister, the replacement for Castro. But see, everyone knows this individual, right? Mm-hmm. Now, just think about your own democracy here in the United States. Now, we claim to have this democratic tradition, and we are somehow related to democracy in the current time, but I don't know any of the people that actually have control over me. I never met any of them. I mean, my congresswoman called me up once asking for money, but that was once in 30 years, And so, you don't really, you can develop relationships with maybe a mayor or, if you're lucky, but a lot of people like in a large city or something, they would never know their mayor, ever get a chance to meet. The only time they ever see the individual is when the black SUV goes by with a police escort.
Yeah.
And so the thing is that small component, what it does is it makes people interested in the political reality. See, that's why I think one change I would make is I would immediately set up very small kind of components of state federalism, where you have like no more than 60 people would elect one individual, and this group then would elect the state legislature. This large group, because this would then you would get people that you would know and could trust, right? You have some real connection into this individual, and get some real feedback to them. So that would be the first kind of structural change that I would like to see made, is the implementation of the Cuban small-time election beginning process. I think this is terrific, and it, you know, so that would be, you know, my little, you know, thought on this is like is get smaller, because what happens is then everyone has a responsibility or and a desire to participate. One of the reasons why people don't participate in democracy, if you look at the voter turnout in the U.S. election, it's almost like, what, 40% or something like that. It's just incredibly low, lowest in the Western world, is because no one gets any kind of immediate feedback from the thing. It's just so these, you get these puppet show individuals that everyone hates one or the other, Clinton, Trump, you know, but there is no real connection into the responsibility of citizenship.
Yeah.
Whereas,
I'm sorry.
Anyway, that would be my thought is like, and if they don't, if the government doesn't do this, and this is kind of like one of the hopeful ideas that is out there, is that, you know, like some of the young technocrats in San Francisco that I know are kind of presenting this Uber model. You know, they just see the Democrats, Republicans are so corrupt. They're just unworkable. It's just a cesspool. It's impossible to work with. I think they don't really appreciate the secret society that controls them. But
yeah.
Their position of that they are unreasonable and cannot be worked is correct. So their idea is they're saying, well, you know, we're just going to replace them with like Uber. We're going to take over all the functions, just as Uber was so technically adroit that the yellow cab, you know, monopolies couldn't withstand it. That we can basically just take over the functions of government one step at a time. I don't know how far that can go, but that's a great idea. It's a great idea to organize basically through technology into doing some of the functions of government. And my hope would be that this smaller size democratic group could just come into existence doesn't even need to be connected into, you know, our election system, which is so corrupt and so controlled by the secret society. We can just develop it our own as citizens, right? And then start connecting to one another in our groups, and then, you know, start basically replacing the government we have with one that actually has some, you know, relationship to democracy.
Yeah, reverse this centralization that's been going on since the late 19th century. Remember, that's been sold to us as progressive, as necessary, as modern, as sophisticated. You know, it's localism that caused all the problems, because that goes back to the, you know, interpretation of the Civil War, and it was states' rights that was a problem. And really, if you get the more local you get, the more responsible government you get, and probably less corruption you get.
It's just preposterous.
Yeah.
Every statistic that I can imagine, if you compare 1950 to the present moment. That measures like quality of life has gone negative, even though supposedly technology has made more advances over the last 70 years than in all human history before. Well, how are these two things possible? Right? How is it possible? It's possible because the programs were destructive. So that means that we have to just work backwards. I mean, it's the only way. There's no other sort of analytic process that can be done. We have to work backward. That means that, you know, that feminism, that integration, that the ending of the family, that pornography, that all of the elements that dominate our culture, we can trace how they came to us, right? Mm-hmm. We can see how they've wrecked us. So to try to make it better, we have to head back in the other direction. We have to start realizing that the ethnic communities with the patriarchal family structure, with dads at work, with moms that were home, we have to start seeing how that was something that actually protected us. It wasn't something that we had to rebel against. You know, they told us, well, the women are, you know, they're like property. Their lives are ruined. There they are having to be mothers. The dad, he should be watching pornography. Why is he having a job, you know, when he could be having the sexual expression that would make him less neurotic, according to Freud.
Yes, right? Yes.
Right? So the thing is that all of this, these worker paradises, you know, were given to everyone as kind of the cover story for this destruction. But, you know, now if in the process to work backwards, I think we can actually probably, hopefully, defend ourselves a bit better. Because when you have some, you know, Freudian psychiatrist who tells you that, you know, you don't really want to have this restraint on sexuality, it'll produce neurosis. I mean, basically, I would just say, well, stay right here. Let me go get a baseball bat.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's just ridiculous. You know, at some point, you know, we can start kind of getting the sophistry and we can get the weaponized anthropology, weaponized psychology. And then we can just say, you know, we're just not going, we have the strength to resist it, which we didn't have in the 60s and 70s, you know, which we didn't have when we were the Woodstock generation or the discotheque generation or with, you know, the cultural Marxists, which were so intimidating, you know, no one stood up against them. But I think now, because we can actually sit here and go, you know, we have been taken off a cliff, right? And everything that is important culturally is in free fall. We hopefully will have, you know, we can find the grit to when these sophists come to us with the bogus science and the weaponized anthropology, we can say, you know, the hell with you. Mm-hmm. Just the hell with you, you know, get out of here. You don't want to leave.
It was sold as liberation, but they were enslaving everybody because they, yeah. You know, that's the old Freemasonic trick right there. Absolutely. I mean, you mentioned, what was going on here? Well, if you can look at it from a marketing standpoint, if you want to look at it that way, if you want to get people addicted, if you want to convert people, degrade them, sort of subject to this reverse chemical process of making them debt-ridden consumers, okay? First thing you got to do is you got to break down their sense of family, then break down community. And when they have nothing left, they still have this longing for something. They want to relate to something. So instead of having a family, an extended family, a community, a parish, you know, and that, you know, something that defines them, these, you know, they become deracinated and they have nothing left. So what do they seek for? They belong to, I don't know, they belong to Apple Corporation because they identify with the Apple product. They identify with certain products. I mean, I think marketers and advertisers, marketing firms developed this, that there's a human psychological need to belong to something. And they, instead of having a family, now they belong to certain brands. You mean, you're a Coke, you're a Pepsi man, you know?
God, you're so right.
You're an Apple guy. I'm a PC guy, you know? And this was weaponized. This was refined. And you see it played out, you know, in the post-war era, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's why, like, Bernays is so useful to study because I wrote a paper with Jan Erwin called Manufacturing the Deadhead. And we go into, you know, that Bernays was at the center, the beginning of all of this. You could see, you know, the weaponization of integration, of feminism, of media propaganda, of you know, overt sexuality, you know, and sexual media. I mean, every single one of these things, there is this guy at the very beginning. I mean, how could he have been at every single origin? You know, well, it's because this was the plan, and he was actually an agent of the plan, and you can see that the one of the individuals that he worked with, or at least had a like a decade long association with, Gordon Wasson.
Mm-hmm.
And you know that they were working together. I mean, the letter that describes their relationship doesn't go into what they were doing, but the fact is, Wasson wasn't just some individual. He was the PR guy for J.P. Morgan Bank.
Yeah, which shows the corporatist connection here.
Exactly. And so you can see that the propaganda elements were, you know, being studied, and then how they could basically use this to take culture into a bad place. I mean, it's just one of the most important relationships that people can understand is that, you know, you have Freud, you have his nephew, Edward Bernays, with the weaponized anthropology component of it. And then you have his decade-long relationship with Gordon Wasson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now Wasson pops up as the individual who's selected to begin the whole drug movement, you know? And of course, this leads to, remember, it's not just drugs, but it's sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It all comes from this, you know, sinister little individual, you know, Gordon Wasson. And we know this is basically, you know, secret society activity because MK Ultra paid for it. You know, no question here. We got the pay requisitions. They're in existence. So, you know, when you talk about the marketing, man, you're right at the core of it, because, you know, the really glamorous kind of crazy things like the Grateful Dead and, you know, Burroughs' trip to the Peruvian jungle, supposedly to find this ancient tradition, which doesn't exist. I mean, these things are spectacular. I mean, these are like kind of eye-popping, sort of startling revelations. But, you know, more important, I think, for people to get is just the day-to-day socialization through the marketing process, you know, because that just goes on 24/7. It's just working against us all the time. And, you know, I'm really happy you brought it up, because it's one of those things. I don't think, you know, maybe at some time we should just do a whole discussion just about this, because it's the everyday marketing that really produces the everyday slave.
Yes.
You know, that's the fact. And so we need to, like, get into the marketing techniques that are being used against us, so that, again, we can find a way to resist. You know, it's life and death. Death and slavery and indoctrination are all the same thing.
Now,
really.
In these talks, you also mentioned the important. You've mentioned cultural Marxism,
yeah.
And there's an ethnic component here.
Sure.
You know what I'm getting at? The American Jewish Committee and its publication of The Authoritarian Personality seem to be working in tandem with the CIA, which we tend to associate with, you know, the WASP elite. But Herbert Marcuse, William Reich, and these guys, they seem to be pursuing a parallel agenda.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There is some – okay, so what you have is you have a really good kind of place to start this analysis would be what's called the MKUltra Union Party, which is a video. You can go – it's YouTube. I mean, they call it the LSD reunion, but it has all these Freemason guys – a whole ton of Jewish psychiatrists, right? And then you get some CIA guys. So you've got Hubbard, you got Leary, and then you've got like Humphrey Osman, right? Now these are supposedly WASP guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you've just got a ton of Jewish psychiatrists: Sidney Cohen, Oscar Janiger, Bursell. I mean, you know, I can't name them all off the top of my head, but just if you see the video, you can see all this. And, you know, one thing I've always wondered when I look at these groups and I go, well, there's two things that I'm not seeing here. I'm not seeing just any run-of-the-mill Christians, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where are they? I mean, you know, it's like, okay, it's kind of like a little bit by self-definition, but, you know, when you look at Leary talking about how he's an adherent of Aleister Crowley, right. Well, this is not a normal Christian. Okay, that's not satanic worship doesn't really like fall into that. And then you got all the Jewish psychiatrists. And then you got like Humphrey Osman and, you know, gigantic Freemason connection through Huxley. So where are the Christians? Why aren't the Christians in this room? And then the other thing I always wonder, I wonder about the Third Reich. Right, the Aryan race rebellion, you know, against these racial ideas. I look at the and I go, where are the blondes in the actual top authoritative positions? You know, I don't see any blondes. Where are they? I mean, I thought they're supposed to be the blondes, that was the Aryan race. And then you get, you know, Goebbels and Himmler and Hitler and these guys, and there's no blondes. Where's the blondes?
That's right.
I don't see the blondes anywhere.
They're only in the posters.
Yeah, I mean, they're in the posters, but they're just not in the. They're not leading anything. Not any kind of power. And so it's the same problem I have with, the MK Ultra Union Party. I'm going, wait a second. There should just be one run-of-the-mill Christian here somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Where is he? Where is the run-of-the-mill Christian? I mean, I got Aleister Crowley, I got the CIA, you know, but not just CIA, but MKUltra, and then I got all these Jewish doctors. I want my Christian. Where is the Christian? There should be at least one Christian in here. One just regular Christian guy who's just like, I'm just a Christian guy, I'm a psychiatrist, but I'm in the picture. I'm in the MKUltra picture. I'm a regular Christian guy. I got no background, you know, anywhere else, but I want to help with this MKUltra. So this is kind of troubling and curious. And I think then when you back calculate from the Macy Conference, what do you get? You know, you get the American Jewish Committee with the authoritarian personality science. And here now you've got personality tests, right?
Mm-hmm.
Got tests for ethnocentrism.
Mm-hmm.
Can't have any of that.
Of all people to criticize that.
Right. You have tests for anti-Semitism. You know, I mean, it's just like, this is so crazy. It's like it makes your head spin. But this then, I mean, but this is, right, the Frankfurt School. This is what you have hired. And now at next, then it pops up in MKUltra.
Mm-hmm.
And wait a second, is this related? Again, it's like within the secret society, you don't have documentation, but you know what you have is circumstantial evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And circumstantial evidence is something that everyone needs to kind of study a little bit, because it's actually the most powerful evidence imaginable, because it's the hardest to fake, because it involves like lifetime activity, lifetime associations, our long-standing associations, our bizarre coincidences, right, that are mm-hmm. unusual, right? This is you know, circumstantial evidence, right? So it's very, very powerful, very good. It's very hard to fake. Unlike, you know, Gloria Steinem's personality or you know, Madonna or something, where you can just create an image and a personality. Circumstantial evidence is very hard to create. So when you look at these relationships between MKUltra and the Macy Conference and the American Jewish Committee, it is a circumstantially strong case of association. In other words, you can say, look, somewhere these individuals that created MKUltra, right, somewhere they came up with a very powerful moral authority. Because when you look at Ewan Cameron's, you know, basically brain or mind slaughtering patients, right, to do these MKUltra experiments, right? When you look at chemical comas for a month with, you know, electroshock and then the psychic driving at the end to make sure that, like, mothers couldn't even remember their children, right? When you look at the moral authority behind the acid tests, right? Just come in off the street, teenagers, and we'll give you LSD, right? Who would have this? Well, you know, the strand of intellectual sort of connections and circumstantial evidence goes right back to the conclusion of the authoritarian personality, right? These were Jewish intellectuals, psychologists, psychiatrists. You know, you have Adorno, Horkheimer, but the whole group is there. I mean, even Herbert Marcuse, who then comes up with Eros and Civilization, he wasn't hired by the group, but he was working for the OSS. He had been with them before, and then he produces Eros and Civilization after the fact, right? So you can say, well, here it is. Here is one, either the cause or something that could be seen as logically in the strand of causality that produces MKUltra. Because in the conclusion of the authoritarian personality, they talk about what we need to do to make sure the Gentile basically doesn't misbehave again, is to develop a mass scale psychological technique, and we need to use Eros, right? Sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
So you see, the problem is, it's sort of like Gloria Steinem's connection into the CIA. The circumstantial evidence is just overwhelming. And it becomes very, very troubling, because what you can end up with is, you can say, you know, there is either a like a long-standing project, or there is influence from, right, this group of psychiatrists and psychologists, anthropologists who have Jewish backgrounds, who wanted to find a way to control Gentiles following World War II. And so that's something which is, you know, you get into this, and of course, you know, you can imagine how often the dreaded anti-Semitism curse is hurled here. But the fact is, it just has to be investigated. It has to be, because it's just so obvious. And I would hope that, you know, righteous Jewish people, to use an expression, would be the ones to really spearhead this investigation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they should really be very, very troubled by this. And they should want to know exactly what inside my ethnicity and religion is in motion inside something as evil as the secret society, which, you know, is obviously something that could have, you know, crypto ethnicity inside it.
Yeah, it's this Talmudic Judaism, which creates a kind of a dialectic or a loop, which creates a reaction.
Yeah.
And so it's continually, it's the rabbinical tyranny, as some people say, where they encourage a behavior which creates a reaction among the host or majority community, and that in turn creates group cohesion among the Jewish minority. And it's the rabbis that like that. It's the rabbinical tyranny that they live
under. They benefit from it because their positions of power are codified, basically, because the congregations have become paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
And now are just racially, I would say, primitive, in the sense that, you know, I mean, on one hand, you know, you can say it that, but on the other hand, at least they have ethnic communities. The Jewish ethnic communities, and of course the state of Israel, are maybe models for Gentiles, you know, to like, well, maybe we should do this, you know, mm-hmm. like just copy it because it works out so well for them, right? So, you know, the rabbinical traditions. I mean, basically, you know, you have to really wonder. If you look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, you have something called the War Scroll, right, which describes a series of battles which end up with an apocalypse against the Gentiles. Gentiles are exterminated. Now, this document was created long before the Roman War. Are perhaps long before the Roman War, and it's probably a reaction to the Roman takeover against the Hasmoneans that Pompey initiated, right? But it's, you know, a very hard-edged genocidal position. It's entwined within the religion. And so one thing I would wonder is, to what extent is this perspective inside the really fundamental components of the religion today? Judaism is a kind of secret society, particularly, you know, and it's, you know, in the areas where it's the congregations are the most sealed off. And to what extent these things are participating in this, you know, possible, you know, strand of energy that's coming forward into MKUltra. You know, this all has to get investigated. Look, yeah. Tim, it's going to get, I'll tell you, I can see almost no way that, you know, going forward isn't going to get ugly. Because here's the facts. The secret society is in motion and it is genociding. And one way or another, there will be some resistance to it. Because as it gets closer to, like, basically zero population of the disposed group, people will start catching on, right?
Yeah.
And so the question is how to make the investigative process go quicker, so that particularly the Europeans, who have been the subject to the vast majority of mortality from this stuff, that they wake up and go, gee whiz, this is going on. I'm going to have to do something about it, and then. Hopefully that the fact that the Gentiles have been brought to the light, to use an expression, that this would have an impact on the secret society. And they would go, well, you know, we really have to basically change direction here and try to find some way to cooperate.
Yeah.
I think as long as people are happy and accepting to be sheep led to the slaughter, you're not going to get any kind of change in behavior or attitude from the secret society. They're just going to, you know, go forward to basically they've gotten rid of everybody and the working class are all robots. You know, that would be their goal. So we need to make the change inside ourselves. We need to investigate everyone. We have to develop really high levels of skepticism about claims made about history because these things are obviously weaponized. We have to develop our thinking skills. This is critical. You know, we need to start training kids from a very young age to be able to use reason and logic, right, to analyze the situation. I would be training kids in reason and logic at the same time I'd be showing them absolutely basic mathematics and, you know, three-letter words.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is critical that we train the children to be able to think clear. Because remember, a lot of them are going to be facing damaged brains. You know, they're going to be, as they go through the toxic environment to get older, they're going to need the technical ability of thinking well in order to be able to defend themselves. So, you know, it's a huge project, but on the other hand, it only requires that we wake up, right? It yeah. seems, you know, as we sit here, like we're talking, we're going, oh my God, you know, look, they've got the iPhone and, you know, they have the plastics in the environment and these longstanding structures, you know, and we're getting wiped out. We can't resist. Nah, all we got to do is wake up. You know, believe me, if you get 600 million people awake, you know, and going, well, wait a second, you know, and they don't have to wake up to some kind of full understanding. They don't have to get to kind of the point of skepticism that you and I are at. They just have to get to the point of skepticism where they say, we don't trust the government anymore. They have to, all they have to do is get to the point where they can use the expression lifetime actor to evaluate mm-hmm. people. They just get to that point where they're going, you know, well, I mean, maybe Bush is a real person, but maybe he's a lifetime actor. Let's study this.
Yeah, or maybe what's being reported as news and leaving news isn't reality. Because it's on television.
Maybe right? It's just total nonsense,
yeah,
you know?
Because it's on television. It's on the Videodrome, exactly. Right? Why would you think what's on that screen has anything to do with reality? It could, theoretically, yes, it could. I mean, the weather report might be trustworthy. But other than that, you know, even...
This is the thing, and that's why, you know, I mean, I just, you know, want to, just whatever I can do to support you, I just rest assured I'll do, because this is really where the battle is. It's people like you and the really good work you've done. And I mean, I like to listen to every interview you do. I think the questions are terrific. And I think the kind of sense you have about how to help the people you're talking to bring out the good information is really, really important. And there's just something about your voice. I said this last time. I was going, you know, your voice is just really. I study voices quite a lot. I mean, it's very interesting because you. I mean, particularly sophistry. You know, I'm good at detecting it. I'm good at kind of seeing the tension around the edges. You know, of individuals that know that they're lying, and their little bit of tension pops up in different words. You know, so you can, if you study it, you can kind of detect it. But at the same time, righteousness and clear-mindedness are also visible. And or you can listen and hear it, and you have it. You just have that honesty and clear-mindedness that, I mean, people, you know, want to communicate with. And so, you know, let's just hope you become a, you know, replace Wolf Blitzer. you know, this would be like just the biggest step towards civilization since the Magna Carta. So, but that's the thing, is that. We need to be an army of researchers, you know, and people like, it's like, I get like, I'm getting a lot of this now, and I don't know, maybe it's just, they're doing it to annoy me, but people always wonder, are you afraid? You know, they go, you must be afraid. And I go, well, why would you think I'm afraid? They go, because they're going to kill you. Right. You're bringing out all this information. And obviously in the secret society, they will react. They'll kill you, particularly now that you're into these really taboo areas. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, you know, maybe, but first of all, there's really not a lot of choice. If you want to, you know, if you have a mind that is basically free, what can you do? You have to, and you have to simply operate within the, you know, the kind of the phenomena that's coming at you. So basically this is what you do. You just describe it to people. And if that's, you know, going to tick these guys off, so be it. But then beyond that, it isn't just any one individual. At one time, I don't know, maybe 20 years ago, 10 years ago, it would have been something, you know, to take the positions and discuss the topics that you and I are doing today. But now there are just thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, yeah.
That these exact same issues, everyone, they're worried about it. They're troubled. And so at this point, we almost are at the point where there is basically safety in numbers. That they doesn't matter if they kill one or two or 20, they cannot kill all of them. And so they're going to have to try to find other ways to create socialization inside of the internet. And frankly, I just am astounded that the progress that we've made. I mean, how many millions of people now are skeptical? The fact that mainstream media has a believability level of like 33% now, I believe the number is. I mean, only a third of people think that actually the information is trustworthy. And the literally, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that are listening to you and people that are in this genre, you know, something's got to give. It isn't the, believe me, you have the title Interesting Times. These are interesting times, Tim, because, you know, these trajectories cannot last for very long. I mean, if you get 20 million people in the United States that are suddenly, you know, basically in this mode of understanding.
Yeah, and that it will radiate from them.
Yeah. You know, well, I mean, for there, yeah. You see, the problem is from that, you're only maybe a month away from 100 million people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so that's the thing is that they understand that. And so there's going to have to be some point of where the rubber hits the road, and they either, you know, bring it all to an end somehow in a way that the communication doesn't continue to develop the you know, a generation, a group that's in opposition to the secret society. You know, are they going to let us? They're basically going to just let us end up with full communication with one another, in which case it's over. Then they have to find a place to go, because we would start overwhelming them with our numbers and also with our, basically, you know, with just our desire for self-preservation.
Mm. So, well, Joe, I want to thank you. It's been we're close to 2 hours now. So that's wow.
Wow. Great. Just goes by so fast. I mean, every time I talk to you, it's like just a few minutes, but thank you so much for having me.
Well, so you're welcome. And certainly thank you for coming back on.
Oh, and I just wanted to mention one thing. You know, I really enjoy your interviews. I've actually listened to the one that you did. I forgot the name of it. But you just give, I don't know, somehow you really have a great synthesis of, you know, the overall structure of reality and civilization.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Yeah, I try to.
More of those. Yeah. In fact, I'd actually, you know, I was thinking about that. I was hoping I want to turn the favor. I want to do an interview of you on one of my shows when you have some time. So
Send me an email.
I will. Yeah. Look forward to that, people, because I really want to pick Tim's brain, and we can, you know, be fun, and I think it'd be really useful. So.
Pick my brain. I have to do most of the talking. I'm not used to that. So
I don't know.
Okay. Well, listen. Certainly we can plan for that. So just
good.
Whenever you want to send me the note, we'll work something out. Well, anyway, that is Joe Atwell. Of course, his website is postfleviana.org.
You know, I just want to say, actually, I'm more available at caesarsmessiah.com.
Okay, caesarsmessiah.com.
If you want to reach me, go to caesarsmessiah.com, and okay. It's just easier for me to deal with that book. The Postleviana title is so confusing. So I'm just really more available now at caesarsmessiah.com.
Okay.
Come to that website if you want to get a hold of me. And thank you so much, Tim.
Great. Listen, I wish you a good night, and enjoy the spring in Santa Barbara. I think, from what I understand, it's the same as the summer and the fall and the winter there. So
it never changes.
Okay. Well, take it easy. Thanks a lot.
Good okay. Night, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
I'd like to spend some time in Mozambique. The sunny sky is at the moon, and all the couples dancing cheek to cheek. It's very nice to stay a week or two and maybe fall in love, just me and you. Time for good romance in every show.